Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This week we have a special episode for you. It's NAIDOC week and we'll be chatting about Aboriginal cultural fishing on the New South Wales south coast. This episode will be in two parts. First, we'll chat with Wally Stewart, a Walbunja man from Naruma, who is one of the leaders of the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group, who are fighting for cultural fishing rights and for an Indigenous voice in fisheries and marine management on the New South Wales south coast. And in the second part of the episode, we'll speak with Andrew Nye. Andrew is a fifth generation Walbunja commercial cultural fisherman from Mogo. And Andrew and some of his family are licensed to fish commercially on the New South Wales south coast, using traditional techniques such as rowboats and handmade nets. We'll hear both their stories and some of the challenges they face in asserting their native title and cultural fishing rights on the far south coast of New South Wales. We hope you enjoy this special episode. Let's begin in Naruma on Yuin Country, overlooking the Wagonga Inlet, speaking with Wally Stewart. All right, we're here in Naruma on the New South Wales south coast with Wally Stewart. Wally, thanks so much for joining me, mate.
You're welcome.
To get started, we're in an absolutely beautiful place looking over the Wagonga Inlet right now. And you just told me there used to be a cannery right in front of us. Do you want to just tell us a bit about, first tell us a bit about yourself and your people and where you're from?
Well, my name's Wally Stewart. I'm born and bred in Naruma. I'm a Walbunja man from the South Coast, part of the Yuin Nation. I'm an applicant for the South Coast Native Title Claim. And I'm also a representative for the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group, which is a group that lobby for people's Aboriginal fishing rights that's been taken away from us over the years.
Mm. So that's what we're here to talk about today. And I mean, there's a lot to get to, but I think to set the scene, it's important to talk about how important fishing is to the Yuin people. So do you want to tell us a bit about how fishing was a part of your life when you were growing up around here and how important it is to your community here?
Well, it wasn't only important to my life, it was important to all Yuin people on the south coast. I think about 85 to 90% of our food, you know, came from the estuaries and the ocean. Yuin people are known to have that, you know, real close ties to the ocean, and we relied on them resources all our life, and we still do. It was a healthy lifestyle. And then my father was a fisherman, and my father and mother moved to Naruma in 1958 and bought a house in Naruma. And he was a fisherman as well. When he moved to Naruma and bought the house in 1958, the white community came around with the petitions to try to move us out because Aboriginal people weren't actually allowed to live in the town. My mum and dad were pretty strong people in them days, and they met the people at the door with their petition and showed them that, you know, their deeds and titles and said, mate, this is our place and we're not moving. So it sort of paved the way for Aboriginal people to actually live in the town. But my father was a fisherman, and then so we set up a shop beside the house, and then he fished all along the coast here, all the local lakes and stuff, and that's how he kept us fed. I was the youngest out of 10 kids, so he fed a lot of us, and he fed a lot of the other Aboriginal communities as well, and taught a lot of other people in communities how to fish and hang nets. And was something that he passed on to us, that I used to come home from school and he'd be sitting out the backyard and he'd be hanging nets, and then I'd try to sneak out the back door to go and play with my mates, and he would say, come here, you, and and then I'd be standing on the other side and he'd be showing me how to hang a net, and I hated it because I wanted to go and play with my mates. But at the end of the day, it's something that once you learn, you never forget, and I was able to, you know, keep this because it's a dying practice, and I was able to pass it on and teach a men's group in Wallaga Lake men's group to hang a net, and a few of the boys up at Bingy, and program's grown.
So hanging nets, you mean building the nets or weaving
yeah,
the
yeah.
nets?
Yeah, yeah, so it's a gill net. Aboriginal people have been using nets, you know, down here for thousands of years, and there's even stories when Captain Cook came here, they seen us using our nets and took it back to England, and that's how the seine net actually come about. The seine nets are the ones that our brothers and cousins use, the Nye brothers, and who still fish with it today. The only thing that's changed over 100 years is they use four-wheel drives. It's one of the most fishing-friendly practices left in the world. It's because they can target their species, and they get little bycatch, and they shoot these nets across sand so it doesn't do any damage to the reefs or anything like that because it's on sand, and they still row their boats. And then the only thing that's changed over 100 years is they use four-wheel drives and, you know, not drag it over the beach or horse and carts.
Yeah. And so what around here, your father as a fisherman around here, what sort of species, you know, were sort of targeted, and what are some of the seafoods that you sort of grew up on around this area?
We grew up with, you know, all the seafoods around here. So our house is in McMillan Road, so we were just around the corner from the boat shed, and you know, we just grew up every day, and my father was a fisherman, so he targeted all the species as well as lobsters and abalone and oysters, and we were pretty privileged to what we grew up with. We didn't have much, but we always had plenty of seafood.
Yeah.
So we worked all the lakes, and then he'd, you know, do the seasons when they come around. Then he'd also chase some sea garfish and stuff like that. And then he taught us where to get lobsters and you know, and then as we were kids growing up, no one knew what abalone basically was. And so we was always walking around the rocks, picking up a bag of abalone for a feed and bartering and stuff. Yeah, it was basically everything that's in our country we actually lived off. Even in Wagonga here, there's middens all around the place and Aboriginal sites where people lived before us. But as, like I said, as the fishing industry grew, it sort of took it away from us and had done a lot of damage to our people because of the change of the diet and stuff, because they weren't able to access it.
We'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
You're one of many, you can tell me how many, but one of many native title claimants here on the far south coast, native title claim.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the claim and about the process of registering it.
Yeah, so just to register the claim, you've got to gather a whole heap of evidence and make sure that the right people are in that area and there's some connection there. So that's a process in itself. That could take 4 or 5 years of gathering all that evidence and all the genealogies of all the Aboriginal people within our boundary of our claim and checking the historical evidence as well as our own people's evidence. So we had an authorisation meeting in 2016, so you could imagine the work that had to lead up to that. And then we had about 600 or 700 Aboriginal people come to the authorisation meeting to authorise the claim to be registered. And then it goes for another process to the Native Title Tribunal, and then they assess the evidence and to see if the evidence is strong enough, and the evidence is strong enough, and then so she was registered in 2018, we became the South Coast Native Title Claim.
Mm.
Yeah, and so now the process is that we are gathering our evidence, and that's a long process as well. But the claim goes from south of Sydney all the way down, it should go all the way down past Victoria, but because of boundaries and politics, went right down to the Victorian border.
Yep.
And it could have went in further. It goes up to the mountain range, which is the Butterwong, and 3 nautical miles out to sea. So it covers up basically the whole coastline down the south coast.
Mm. Tell me a bit about when finally, after all that work, the claim was registered. What was the feeling like? Like, how did it feel for yourself and for the community?
It was overwhelming because we've been having a battle down here, you know, with fisheries, you know, for the last 40 years. They've really done a lot of damage to our communities along the coast. Probably in the last 10 years, we've had over 600 engagements with Aboriginal people just down here on the south coast. Fisheries, them engagements are from just warnings, fines, and then prosecutions, where they got warrants and bonds and even right down to sending people to jail.
Mm.
And we've never ever seen that as a crime. We've always seen our fishing practice as part of our culture. We've been doing it forever. All the practice that we do is, you know, we've been taught. I still go to places down here where my father showed me where lobster nests are, and, you know, I'm 61 now and, you know, I can still go back there and get some lobsters out of them places. And so that's something that we've passed on. And then because of the impact of colonisation and setting up Aboriginal reserves, like Wallaga Lake was the first Aboriginal reserve, you know, in Australia, because we were the first contact of Captain Cook. So we felt the impact first, and then Aboriginal reserves were set up, and there was policies called segregation and assimilation, and I've herded Aboriginal people on the mission, and then we're, you know, denied our language and our food, and we're given rations, bully beef and sugar and flour and tobacco. But our people still was able to fish, and they were given a boat and net at Wallaga, and so that actually subsidised their rations and were able to compromise that healthy lifestyle.
Take us back to, you've been fishing and gathering and stuff around here your whole life. Tell me a bit about how you would fish to feed the community, and then when things began to change and when prosecutions began and when Aboriginal people around here started being targets of fisheries and prosecution.
Well, was like as a kid, we grew up here on the on the coast, and my father was a fisherman. But we spent a lot of time out on the ocean and camping and family gatherings and stuff like that. Mystery Bay's a really special place. Abalone was like, for our mob down here, was like bread and butter. We ate it every day, and it was easy to get because we could walk around on the low tide. We didn't even have to dive for it. And it wasn't until the abalone industry actually came along in the late 70s, early 80s, and then all of a sudden, we're still going out diving and, for lobsters and abalone and fishing and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, this abalone industry came along and then started prosecuting us and said, we weren't even given the opportunity to be part of it. They just came along and took it away.
So is it the beginning? So in terms of abalone, as soon as the commercial abalone industry started to really take off, was when they started limiting the sort of the cultural take or your ability to take?
We didn't even know what was going on. Like this fishing industry started, we're talking about in before Aboriginal people had rights. We never became citizens till 1967. Mm. This fishing industry was set up in the 30s.
And that's one of the reasons as to why there was absolutely no involvement of Aboriginal people in the industry, and there still isn't today.
We used to eat them in the early days and people didn't even know what they were.
Mm.
But then, when this abalone industry came along, then I think, it's pretty common that DPI, Fisheries Government, seen it as moneymaker and, venture, and, and then they got the market and started exporting them overseas, and, so they protected that industry. And then when they started protecting that industry, they started policing our guys that had been doing this all their life. And so we were made out to be, criminals and organised crime and black mafia, you name it. But our guys just seen it as, cultural practice. We bartered and traded with it as well. So we were being criminalised basically when the abalone industry came along.
Mm.
And it's still today where they, they protect that industry because they pay a lot of money for them shares.
Mm. And so tell us about beginning in the 90s and through till today is when you've seen a really large increase in the amount of prosecutions and the way that Aboriginal people are targeted, taking abalone, and we'll sort of focus on abalone at the moment because that's where a lot of the prosecutions and things have been around.
Yeah, that's right. Some of our guys got their first criminal records from fishing.
Right. And so tell us about how, firstly, let's talk about the health issue and how these prosecutions impact on the health of the Aboriginal community.
Yeah, well, when they started prosecuting our people, coming down on us and saying that, these resources are theirs and we had no right to take them. And we done a case study and in 2016 and we highlighted the damage that this government, or every time they put a regulation on us, the damage that it done to our community. So we were looking at a change of diet. So that created heart disease, diabetes. And then because of they were too scared to go out and fish anymore because every time they turned up, fisheries and the police were there trying to lock them up. So there was that mental health issues and loss of culture because they were too scared to take their kids out to fish and teach them. Then they were sent to jail and then they were coming out with mental health issues and their families were breaking down. And so all these issues were highlighted in the case study that we'd done, and it nearly severed two generations of culture fishing. And it was all because of they just wanted to protect this one industry. Mm. But no one even knew what it was, 30 years before that, what an abalone was,
Tell us about how the work that you do with the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group works to now, in conjunction with the native title claim, to change this practice and these prosecutions and some of the cases that are a part of that.
Yeah, so the New South Wales Fishing Rights Group is made up of a whole heap of concerned Aboriginal people. We've just had enough of what's been happening down here and the way fisheries have destroyed our way of life, and we've been doing this for thousands of years, and all of a sudden they come along and say they own these resources and throwing our people in jail, really destroying our way of life. And so the Fishing Rights Group got together and said, no, we've had enough. And we all went up and done a protest at Browlea in I think it was 2015. We didn't realise how many people were impacted by it, and we had 180 people turn up, and then they came in telling their stories, and there was no good stories, amongst them all. Everyone had been prosecuted and, their families were starving, something that they were taught, and handed down to how to feed their families. A lot of them down on the, our people on the South Coast live below the poverty line. There's no work down here, but they know how to fish and know how to feed their families, and that creates that healthy lifestyle. So the Fishing Rights Group got together and then, you know, the Native Title Act came along in 92, and then the Fisheries Management Act had to be amended in 93 to accommodate that. So there's a section in the New South Wales Fisheries Management Act called Section 211 of the Native Title Act, which exempts us from the Fisheries and the Marine Park Management Act for culture fishing. And then because of this abalone industry, they totally ignore it, and they still ignore it today. So we've had to challenge them, and when they prosecute our people for exceeding their bag limit, which is, you know, their bag limit, not ours, they'd take us to court. So we would challenge them cases and use Section 211 as a defence, because they choose to ignore that. It's in their Fisheries Management Act. It's in there. So we've had a couple of cases thrown out, probably, you know, four or five, or a lot more actually. So we have to gather all of our information to use that Section 211 as a defence. So we have to go and gather that, you know, that information on that person. We have to gather his genealogy, to say that he's a member of this, you know, South Coast Native Title claim, and, you know, he's exempted from the Fisheries Management Act. So they would still prosecute us and take us right to court, and then like a day or two before the court case, they would drop the case. So they're basically wasting taxpayers' money. And they still do it. And
Why do you think they do that? Why do you think that if they now know that there's a precedent that these cases won't stand up in court, and then they throw it out a couple of days before the trial, why do you think they go ahead with the arrests and the seizures and the prosecution and that whole part of the process?
Pretty obvious. They're there to protect an industry, because we've had words with them, fisheries, and said, why don't you go and tell these guys that we've got a right under the Act? And then their answer to that, you need to go and talk to the abalone industry every time they ring up and see you blackfellas out there diving, we've got to act on it. You know, and I said, well, why don't you go and tell them that we've got a right, you know, under Section 211, it's in your Fisheries Management Act. Like, for me, that's straight out discrimination. You know, it's their Fisheries Management Act has been amended with a Commonwealth law that sits over the state, and they choose to ignore it. So to me, this government is discriminating against our people and protecting this one little, you know, industry who pays a lot of money. And the amount of abalone they've taken over the years since that industry set up, like, is unbelievable. And every time our people go out and get a little bag full, or, you know, even a couple hundred abs, it's nothing compared to what they've taken out of this water along our coastline. One stage there, they were taking 350 tonne a year. Well, between all our mob on the south coast, we'd be lucky to take 3 or 4 tonne a year. Yeah, none of our guys dive with boats and air compressor and stuff like that. They all just jump off the rocks. They're lucky to dive 2 metres deep. But they betrayed us as, you know, the black mafia, and, you know, when they catch our mob exceeding their bag limit, which is 2 that doesn't feed our, you know, suitable for our mob, and it's like we said, we never gave them away. They just came along and took them away. So this is the beauty about the native title. You know, we're gathering our evidence, and because it goes 3 nautical miles out to sea, and you and people are really connected to the water, that's what Katungal means. That's what our medical service, Katungal means sea people, and that's who we are. So the evidence is coming out pretty strong, and it's going to show, you know, it's going to basically hopefully set us free and make them pay at the end of the day. I'm disappointed that we have to go this far. You know, that they think they can just come along and take our resources away and lock our people up and destroy our way of life to protect one little industry. You know, because it's a money-making industry. And then, you know, our people, like I said, never gave them resources up, and we're going to fight. We've been fighting back, and that's what the Fish and Rights Group's about, is about protecting our rights, keeping our culture alive, and, you know, stopping our mob from going to jail.
What do you say to people, and I've heard this and I've read this, that if Indigenous people are allowed to take from anywhere and there are no restriction, then there are no limits, and there is no integration of fisheries management, commercial fisheries management, and Indigenous cultural fishing, that will end up with a negative for sustainability. What do you say to people who sort of put forward that argument? And where do you find, is there a way to find a middle ground, or is there a possibility for a middle ground, or does the government have to take some quota away from the commercial sector?
Good question. Well, that's one of my arguments, is that we've never ever had the opportunity to have a say in management in our own waters and country, and we looked after this water a long time before they came along here and raped our ocean, basically. And the fellows who are still diving, which is a lot of our mob along the coast, that's how they make a living. That's how they feed their families. Everything that they take out of that water goes back to their families and make a living out of it. And they're angry. They're pissed off because of the way they've been treated for the last 30 years because of this abalone industry. What we're saying is, you know, look at the damage that this department's done. It's the only department in New South Wales that doesn't employ Aboriginal people. So it's obviously a redneck apartment, and it's been like that forever, and it's because of, it's a money-making industry. Like National Parks is a great example where they employ over, 350 Aboriginal people across the state. They do MOUs, handbacks, co-management, Indigenous land use agreements to look after and work with Aboriginal people to look after country. So we've been lobbying fisheries to sit down with us and work out a plan and come together and work with us to look after country. We know that the damage is already done here now. We've got sea urchin barrens right along the coast. 50% of our reefs are gone have died and taken over by sea urchins. We believe that it's because of overfishing. They can call it climate change and global warming, but our mob have seen it and they're identifying it now that places I used to go in the last 10, 15 years are not there no more. It's just covered in sea urchin barrens. So at the end of the day, where we are now is we want to build a relationship and we want to have a say in management and we want our water fixed up. Mm. And we shouldn't have to pay. They should pay to do that. But we want to work together. And so we're in the process of working with our whole community along the coast and designing a sea country plan.
Mm-hmm.
So and that'll highlight not only sustainability and looking after the environment, but also economic development as well for our community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why should we shouldn't have been left out of the equation in the first place? And for the abalone industry, why do they still want to take 100 tonne a year? They know that they've got no future if they keep doing it. Why don't they knock them off the air or start looking at some mechanism to start working with us too? The bottom line is it's an old saying down here amongst you and people. If you've got healthy country, you've got healthy people. Well, we haven't got healthy country, we haven't got healthy water.
Mm.
And until we fix that problem, we're not going to have healthy people.
Mm. And so with the development of the Sea Country Plan and the work that you're doing with the Fishing Rights Group, has there been any engagement from DPI and fisheries or levels of government at the moment to start this conversation and get to a table and begin discussing this?
Yep. So we've had a couple of discussions with some senior people in DPI. At the end of the day, the simplest way is they know that our evidence is strong for our claim. There's lawyers out there that said it's probably one of the strongest sea claims in Australia because of the way you and people are connected to the water. So at the end of the day, we'll get a determination. But the easiest way is they could come to us with an Indigenous land use agreement. And if they come to us with an Indigenous land use agreement, an ILUA, that could highlight all the things that we're talking about. So this sea country plan that we design with our community could be the model for the future of our waters on the South Coast. And that's hoping that if we build it properly, that all the stakeholders, because we're not stakeholders, we're traditional owners, all the stakeholders will work with them to have their input into it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, we want to have a say in management and we want to be looking after our country, and government needs to pay for all the, we've got no mining companies here, but as far as I'm concerned, this government's mining our waters with all the resources they're taking out.
Mm.
They need to pay for that compensation for the last 250 years. Right to the point is that we need to work together to fix up our waters in our country.
Well, it's a pretty straightforward thing, but it's also a pretty sad thing that you and your group and your community are so willing to come to the table with government, not even necessarily laying out your own plan, but just saying let's chat about this, let's talk about this, and let's come to an agreement and move this conversation forward. But you've been unsuccessful in doing that so far.
Yeah, well, probably in the last 6-7 years is the first time that fisheries have actually listened to us. It's only because land rights wasn't won because we sat there and done nothing. We had to get out there and protest and make a noise and basically embarrass the government, to get to where we are today. Goes right back before the referendum and the walk-offs and all the land rights issues. Well, this is just another one, but it shouldn't be happening in this time. We're in 2021, and it's still happening. We shouldn't happen to be sitting there and telling them or trying to make them understand that, look what you're doing. You're destroying our way of life. We're here. You took this office. You stuffed it up. Stop pretending all the time. Get your head out of the sand. You're straight out discrimination with your Commonwealth Act that had to fit into your Fisheries Management Act in 94, and you still choose to ignore it and still teach your fisheries officers to totally ignore it and just police us under their state laws and hope that our mob don't understand and or appeal it and then fight us in court, because that's what's happening. That's what's happened in the past. You've destroyed, like I said, some of our people have got their first criminal record for fishing.
Mm.
And so it's sad that we have to sit here and keep fighting about it.
Mm.
When in this day and age, when they're choosing to pretend that there's not a problem going on right now with the sea urchins,
mm.
you know, right along our coast. Now, if anybody who lives on this coast, you know, we live in the most beautiful country. I'm proud of that. And but you look out on the water and it's beautiful. You put your head under the water, and all these people who use this water, you put your head under the water and have a look at that ocean. And what happened to all that weed, you know? All that lobster weed where we used to go and, you know, and dive, and it was full of grouper and fish and lobsters and abalone. It's not there no more. And it's because of the overfishing. And fisheries just keep on allowing it to protect this abalone industry, but it's enough's enough. Knock them off the air. Let them free dive. You know, start taking some quota away from them. Start looking after the country. Teach them about sustainability. This is what's got to happen. We can't keep going on like this.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, we're going to get a determination. We're confident. Native Title is about descent and connection, right? We showed our genealogy. There's 60 family groups in this claim along the coast. Most were all married into each other and related in some form, but it's also connection. And them prosecutions or them 600 engagements, we can use that evidence against them because that shows them that we're still connected to our country. So that's what Native Title's about. It's about descent, connection.
Mm.
So, you know, and that's without all the other written anthropologist reports and
yeah.
And our people, the writings when they first come here, you know, people feeding people when they were starving, our mob giving them fish and trading and bartering and stuff like that. So that's what Native Title's about. Fisheries are better off working with. They should be funding this, and we've put in some funding to start doing this sea country plan so we go to all our communities so everybody has input to this.
Mm.
And then we're working with, you know, Wollongong University, and they're going to help us, you know, put this together. We're working with IATSIS. They're going to help us put this together, a plan, and, you know, support this sea country plan. This sea country plan is not a first. There's some sea country plans all over Australia, and they're successful. It's just a roadmap. But it's by the people. It's made by the people, not told what to do.
Mm.
Like, we don't want fisheries coming to us and saying, this is what we're going to give you. We'll say, get stuff.
Mm.
You know, this is what we want. It's time for change. It's time for us to work together.
Mm. Let's talk a bit about some of the other things that you do with the Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group and about maintaining culture and fishing and stuff. And just before we started, you showed me a video of a new boat that's here on the Wagonga Inlet that's being used with some nets and things like that.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about those sorts of things that you do with the group.
Yeah, so what the Fishing Rights Group does as well is it's a way of keeping culture alive. So, of course, Wallaga Lake was the first Aboriginal reserve set up in Australia, and they had a boat and net. But a lot of people still remember them days down there where they used to go out and fish and set the net in Wallaga Lake, and then they'd all come back and share the catch out, and people had a healthy lifestyle. And anyway, as the commercial fishing industry grew and, you know, them things were taken away from our people and it started to die, and hanging a net or making a net is a dying practice. And all our people up and down, all them old fellas up and down the South Coast knew how to do that. And, you know, I was lucky, I suppose, that my father, you know, was a fisherman, then part of my chore was to help hang the nets, mend the nets, and go fishing with him. We had no choice. So I seen it as a dying practice. So we, one of the programs that we put in for a grant, and we taught the worked with Jimmy Taylor in Naruma and Mel's boat building, and went down there and negotiated with them. I said, how about, you know, we teach the boys how to make a net boat. And then I put in for some, you know, the same grant. I put in for an outboard motor, and then I got all the net. And then I went down to the men's group, and I used to go down there once a week, sometimes twice a week, and work with the men's group and teach them how to hang the net. So they actually made their own net. And
mm-hmm.
So they do that now. They fish their community once a week and then share the catch out amongst their elders, because our elders, are in the case study, getting back to the case study, had highlighted that our mob are you know, low in protein and iodine, which you get from fresh fish. And then because of, you know, all the old people who can't access it no more and even can't even afford it, so I was able to give that meal back to our community, to our elders as well. So mm. that catch we had this morning will probably feed, you know, 30, 40 people in our community, 30, 40 families in our community today.
Mm. And so where does the use of these nets in the estuaries and things like that lie when it comes to, you know, legality? Is that a cultural fishing access thing?
Well, that's another argument I'm having now with, you know, the guys in DPI. When we first put the net project together at Wallaga Lake for the Wallaga Lake men's group, we put in a permit. It's called a Section 37 permit. We didn't need to, because we could have fished under culture fishing. And the reason we put it in is because we knew they were going to get backlash from the wider community. So we agreed to put in the permit to fish once a week under their state regulations.
Yep.
Put all these, you know, bullshit regulations on us. And we did that because we wanted to break the barriers down with the wider community.
Mm.
Because the white community, as soon as they see a black fella out there, they ring up the fisheries and say, you know, there's a black fella out there fishing or a black fella out there diving. There's a reward for that. You know, they get $1,000 reward to dob in a black fella.
Yeah, right.
And it actually worked because the day we went and, you know, launched the new boat and net, before we even got the boat in the water, they had two phone calls.
Oh, really?
DPO had two phone calls to say there's some black fellas out at Wallaga Lake netting. So that's a classic example of the reason why we put the permit in, the Section 37 permit, to go on net. But now, after that, we're saying, no, we're not going to put that Section 37 permit in anymore, because the people who are using this net and doing this fishing practice are traditional owners. They're part of this native title claim, and we'll be fishing under our native title rights, which is Section 211 of that Native Title Act.
Mm.
They're still trying to make us fill in a Section 37 permit, and we're saying no, because once we fill in that permit, we're giving up our native title rights.
Mm.
And this is what they're trying to do. They're still trying to con our people up, fill in this Section 37 permit, control us, basically.
Mm.
And we're saying, no, get stuff, you know.
Did you fill in that permit for Naruma?
The first one was for Wallaga Lake, and then last year we done a permit for Wagonga and Mumiga.
Yep. And so going forward from here, no more permits?
Yeah, no more permits.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're headbutting. So we're just waiting. We were thinking that the fisheries would have been waiting there at the boat ramp for us this morning and laid all the charges and done all their stuff.
Do you think
ready to fight it, because it's, you know, he's a 74-year-old man who's netting there today.
Yeah.
You know, that's all he knows is fishing, and that's what keeps him healthy. You know, he's been prosecuted probably a dozen times. So we were expecting them to turn up today, but they didn't. And we don't want to have that argument. But my point is that if they prosecute him, we'll be just taking him back to court again. We'll be using Section 211 of the Native Title Act as a defence.
Yep.
Then they'll throw it out again. Right. The last case cost the government $139,000 of taxpayers' money.
Mm.
You know, you're trying to prosecute. Like, the extent they go to prosecute a blackfellow is unbelievable.
Mm.
Like, one of the early cases that was done up in Nowra with a couple of the guys, we had a really sharp lawyer, and he actually subpoenaed the fisheries emails and the police's emails and, you know, for the court case, and it showed the extent that they went and showed each other their emails to prosecute this blackfella.
Mm.
And this is the games that they play just to destroy our lives. And when I say destroy our lives, it's really destroyed people's life. One of our old fellas got, you know, he got prosecuted and sent to jail, and it was the first time he was in jail, and for an Aboriginal elder man who was taken to jail and going through that system and stripped naked and made to stand there, and it was devastating for him. And his kids were trying to come and visit him, and he was too ashamed to let his kids see him in jail, and his wife and stuff like that. And he was a breadwinner of that family. And then when he was in, he'd done 9 months for that. And then when he was in jail, his family broke down. You know, he was, and all the other people that he fed as well. And then he come out a broken man, destroyed not only him, like, the impact doesn't just stop there. The damage ripples right through our whole community. But they don't understand that. I don't know if they do or they don't, but they don't care about it. You know, as I see it, you know, in New South Wales, they passed culture fishing in 2009. You know, in Parliament, and we're in 2021, and today it still hasn't been enacted. So, you know, what does that tell you?
Mm.
You know, what does that say to our mob? We're talking going on, what, 12 years.
Mm.
And, like, when you pass something in Parliament, it usually comes to law the next day. Well, we're still waiting for culture fishing to be recognised by them.
Mm.
So, you know.
Do you think that, having sort of done a bit of research and meeting you in the past and learning about this situation, do you think that there's enough education out there? And in terms of, you know, talking about people calling up fisheries when they see people on Wallaga Lake using the nets, you know, people calling out your mob in the water when they're diving for abalone or something like that, do you think that there's enough education for the broader community to make them understand this issue and to get people on board with cultural fishing rights on the South Coast?
I mean, the education needs to be embraced by government as well. Fisheries don't do that. We're the ones who've been trying to get out there and educate our community. When they say, we've been copping it, you know, forever, they're saying, oh, you fellas are black mafia, and you're going, you know, use organised crime. And when we get a bag of abalone, they lay them all out on the footpath and count them all out, and then they bring the media in here, and then they got the blackfella in handcuffs, and then they got the paper there, and they betrayed us like that, you know. And that's what we're saying. And then it's only in the last, you know, fishing rights groups come along and we're saying, hey, That bloke's only taken, you know, probably 20, 30 kilos. He's got a whole industry there. It's taken, you know, 200 ton a year.
Yeah.
You know, who's raping the ocean around here? Who's the poachers? You know, so fisheries are not going to do that education, but that's what we've been doing. We've been telling the other side of the story,
yep.
You know, and it's hard when, you know, you still got the appliance officers right across New South Wales told just to police us under their state regulations and forget about that Native Title Act.
Mm.
You know, it's, so that's... It comes back to the discrimination again. And it's their own law. Our mob are angry. They're really pissed off. And we've got to teach them to, hey, come on, you know, we're TOs, understand what's happened. You know, it's our duty of care to, you know, take care of country and look after country. You know, we need to start planning 6 or 7 generations ahead to fix this country, not just, say, tomorrow. You know, so what we've been doing is a lot of education programs. I do a lot of presentations around... I just done one in Adelaide a couple of months ago, and a researchers' conference and a native title conference, and we showed highlighted the impact of what's happening here on the south coast and how it's been discriminated and how it's you know what it's done to it, the damage it's done to our people, and people don't get to see that. And it's probably a good time now because you know it's NAIDOC week this week.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and it's talking about healing country. Well, you know, healing country. If you're going to heal country, you have to tell the truth. You know, otherwise we're not going to heal nothing, you know, and then we've got to start working together. I'm prepared to sit at a table and compromise, and I know our mob will, at the end of the day, because they care about this country like I do, and we want to look after this country. We want our kids to see what I've seen. We had a great upbringing on the coast, and, you know, and our fathers always looked after country.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good way to end it, Wally. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap it?
Well, we've still got some court case running this week.
Right.
You know, but that's that just goes to show.
Is that more ab diving? And
yeah,
stuff?
That just goes to, you know, they've been running. Some of them have been running for 2 and 3 years, and well, we're hoping in the next 12 months, 2 years, that can sit down with the same table with fisheries and come together and talk with respect with each other. It's like I said, we're sick of being treated as a stakeholder. We're traditional owners, not stakeholders, and we want to look after this country too. And we know that if we all put our heads together, we can do this. We can achieve this.
Yeah, I think that it's important as well for anyone that's listening to understand that anyone can engage on these sorts of issues and write to their ministers and make their voices heard. So I think that's important for people to note as well. It's NAIDOC week this week, and I hope that there's a lot of people listening who are just hearing about this for the first time and that they can engage some way as well. Wally, thanks for joining me, mate.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Cheers. Okay, so that was the first part of this episode. We now take you to Mossy Point on Yuin Country, where we're speaking with Walbunja Man and commercial cultural fisherman, Andrew Nye. Andrew, thanks so much for joining me and having a chat.
You're welcome, yeah.
So, to begin with, do you want to just tell me a bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm Andrew Nye, and I've been a cultural commercial fisherman since I was 14. I was born in Batemans Bay, 12 km from where I live right now, so I'd have to be a local, and I've done nothing but fish all my life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And what does a cultural commercial fisherman mean?
Well, we say like culture, like it's still practicing and our what we know about fishing down, and that's all culture to me. And I think that we should be allowed to continue it without any interruptions because it's one of the oldest cultures in the world.
Mm.
So we should be allowed to practice it and teach our young ones, which going back probably 7 or 8 years ago, I weren't allowed to really teach them because grandchildren and nephews and nieces and stuff like that weren't allowed to help us with our fishing because of restrictions put on by the fisheries department.
Mm. And so... Were you sort of granted a cultural commercial licence? Is that how it works? How does the licensing situation work?
No, we was issued one by the department for $2.
Right.
And
is that a family licence?
That was an individual licence.
Okay.
But our fishing business was always belonged to my dad and his dad prior to that sort of thing, so like my grandfather. And we each had a fishing licence, but Dad owned the business. And then when Dad passed away, my eldest cousin run the business because he was the eldest. And then later on down the track, the department decided to split it up into 3 separate businesses. So that way then we was paying 3 separate lots of money to them
right.
to work the one business.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, that was wrong for them to do that, you know, because when that was done, then family weren't allowed to help me with the net unless they was endorsed to do so.
Mm.
And had a fishing license and were endorsed to do it, because they could have got a fine and I could have got a fine.
Mm. Why don't you tell me a bit about the practices that you use as a cultural commercial fisherman, you know, that are a part of your culture and that are different to what other commercial fishermen would use around here?
Well, we only beach fish. We make our own nets. We buy the net in bulk and we make our nets and put them together and whatever. And we use four-wheel drives to tow our boats and nets down onto the beach and catch the fish and cut our fish off with the trucks and to the co-ops and whatever, where my grandfather and my dad done. They used to catch the fish. They'd carry the boat down to the beach. They'd catch the fish. And they'd carry the boat net back up off the beach, and they'd basket the fish up over the sand dunes into the truck. Mm. Well, the only thing we do different is we use a four-wheel drive.
Mm.
We still row our boats. We haven't got motors on them. But there's other commercial fishermen that do the same thing. But I was always a cultural fisherman before I became a commercial fisherman.
Mm-hmm. And what are sort of some of the species that you chase around here?
Mainly this time of the year it's mainly salmon. You don't get much of anything else. We used to chase a lot of garfish in the summer time around Christmas time sort of thing, and then the department has taken most of that off us because we only have 40 shares, and off that 40 shares I'm only allowed to catch 640 kilos of garfish a year.
Mm-hmm.
Where prior to that I could go out and catch 3, 4, 5, 6 ton of garfish a year.
Yeah, right.
So Just to put your net in and catch, 640 kilos, it's not worth doing it because we've done shots where we've caught like 2 or 3 ton of garfish, you know, and we've had to tip them out just keep 640 kilos, and that's just like watching money swim away from you, you know.
Yeah, you've got to release, and I mean, how do you even measure it while you're on a boat trying to weigh up 640 kilos out of your nets?
Yeah, well, we sort of pull our nets to the shore back onto the beach.
Right, right.
So therefore, if you pull a net back to shore and you pull a garfish out of the water, they're going to die before you can get your 640 kilos out, and then you're supposed to take the remaining ones out that's already dead and dump them out to sea.
Yeah, right.
And then they wash up the beach and they get to blame for them.
Yeah.
Us guys.
Yeah, right.
But now we sort of argue on back saying, you know, like, we should be allowed to still catch a certain amount of garfish, 2 or 3 ton of garfish a year, which can pay you where 640 kilos is not going to pay you.
Mm. What are some of the other species? Mullet as well?
Yeah, we catch mullet. We concentrate on the mullet mainly through the middle of March. You know, they don't go for very long. That they're seasonal fish.
Yep.
And they come out of the rivers around, you know, it all depends on whether the weather's right for it. And they'll come out of the rivers and they migrate north. And you've got to catch as many of those as you can because that might only last 4, 5 or 6 weeks.
Mm.
You know, and if you get bad weather like rain and strong winds, they don't come in onto the beach like they normally do. They stay out in the deeper water and you can't catch them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Do you fish the estuaries as well?
Only do prawning.
Oh, okay.
And the department tried to stop us from doing that because me and my son had 125 shares for prawning. Then the department says we've got to buy another 25 shares to go and do what we've done for all our life sort of thing. Yeah. And they're telling us we've got to go and buy another 25 shares for me to take a boat and net down and for him to take a boat and net down.
Yeah.
Otherwise we've got to combine our shares and just take the one boat.
Yeah.
So they keep pushing us into a corner, but I refuse to do that. I'll take my boat and net down and I'll go and fish as a cultural fisherman.
Mm.
And they can't stop that.
Mm.
You know, they can try if they want to, but it won't stop me. They can throw them in jail if they want to, but I'll go and fish as a cultural fisherman. I've already told them that, you know, and I will do it.
Yeah, I think one thing that I remember, growing up around here is seeing you guys in the dunes constantly watching the ocean. Do you want to tell us a bit about how it works when you're watching the ocean, what you're looking for, and that practice?
Well, when we concentrate on the mullet run, like we'll get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, we'll leave about up past 4 or 5 o'clock, and we'll come and sit down on the beach and it's still dark. We just sit up on a little high peak on the sand dunes and we just watch for the fish to come, and you know, and we can stay there all day and, you know, not catch a fish. Or we can see the fish and still not catch them until late in the afternoon time. So then when we catch them, this is mullet, and when we catch them, then we've got to have them transported to Bermagui. If you catch them late in the afternoon time, you might not get back from Bermagui till 1, 2 o'clock or a bit later in the morning, back up at 4 o'clock and do the same thing the next day.
Mm.
Yeah. But if you don't catch no fish, it's a long day.
And so you're on the dunes there literally just looking for them in the water, and when you spot them, you can row your boats out and put a net around them?
Yeah, we can tell what type of fish they are, and we can tell pretty close how many is in that patch of fish.
How did you learn that? Did you learn that from your family?
Yeah, from Dad and that. You know, he had really good eyes. Like my son Craig's got good eyes. He can see fish when it's still dark, just about. But we can catch mullet, because mullet are surface fish. We can catch them at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning if it's a full moon and it's a clear night.
Right.
Because they're a surface fish and they live awake on the top of the water.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Do you do that same spotting for salmon and other species?
Salmon are a bit different. Even salmon can be a surface fish like mullet, but salmon mainly in the wintertime, they're a hard fish to see. They scatter out a lot on the bottom and they stay on the bottom. They're not right on top of the water mullet. But we more or less do the same thing. We sit up on the high peak and we watch for the patch of fish come, and then we go and get ready for them.
Yeah.
But you've got to have a... No matter what type of fish you catch, you've got to have a nice flat bottom beach sort of thing. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time because you'll lose them.
Mm.
Yeah. And we do catch whiting and brim and stuff like that.
What has been your major sort of market for the fish that you catch since you've been commercially fishing? Really?
Well, so one of our main markets used to be the salmon, Australian salmon.
Yep.
This is going back many years. We used to catch them, and no matter what we caught, we could catch 5, 6, 10, 15 tonne a day. And they'd go to Eden, because Eden used to can the salmon
to
down
the cannery.
There.
And that was pet food, was it?
No, that was canned food too.
Oh, canned salmon. Yeah, okay.
You know, and then when the cannery closed down, it threw a spanner into the works, and we could only catch enough then to put into the markets, into the Melbourne market and the Sydney market. But our mullet, we concentrate on the mullet in late March. They go to Brisbane to be processed up there for the egg roe.
Yeah, okay. Mm. Oh, for the roe?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, they use the fish as well?
Yeah, I'd say so with organisations like that. I don't think they just buy the fish and just take the egg roe out and throw the rest away. They'd do something with it.
They'd be doing something with it. One thing that I remember being a young kid growing up around here was, and our house is just on Massey Street, and we'd go over the dunes, and when you guys would have a good haul, the whole community would come down and help you bring the nets in.
Yeah, you were allowed to do that them days.
Mm.
But then later on down the track, like only going back probably about 5-6 years ago, you weren't allowed to do that.
Mm.
Like you couldn't go and touch a net or anything like that, otherwise you'd get into trouble because you weren't endorsed to do it. They called it an increased effort to catch more fish. But it's not the case, because I've told the department, I said, the only time we put an increased effort in to catch more fish is when the mullet run are on, because it can last like 6 or 8 weeks, the sort of thing, and can be over, or can be over before that if you got the bad weather and floods, you know. So that was one of the things.
And when it comes to the Aboriginal community around here, that community participation in hauling the nets and things like that is all a part of your culture.
Yeah, it is, yeah, because, you know, And I don't know how they find out, actually, because we can be over the beach here today on Barlings Beach or over on Candle, and we can catch a patch of salmon or mullet or whatever, you know. And family just turn up, you know. They turn up, they help, they get a feed of fish and they go. But at the end of the day, it's just the ones with the commercial ones with the license are still there.
Yeah.
But we do get family members come in and help us out, yeah.
Yeah.
Because to me, like with the fishing, you know, and I tell fishers, I said, there's no really, the only increased effort really that goes into us, helping us with the patch of fish, family helping us, is that we can get those fish out of the water, onto our trucks, down to Bermagui, weighed up and on ice, an hour or hour and a half earlier than we would if there was just the five of us.
Mm.
You know, so by us not being able to get our fish to the co-ops and weighed up and in the cool rooms quick, the fish are deteriorating sort of thing, so then again you're putting the public's health at risk.
Mm.
You know, so the idea is to just get them down there and on ice as quick as you can.
Has there been any understanding from you know, fisheries and things like that, that's the case? That doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be catching more fish to have people help you bring in nets?
That's just their rules and regulations, because to me, they've made it so hard on us, like they've taken everything off us.
Mm.
You know, like my dad used to first started diving for abalone, you know, and he was only getting sixpence a pound from, which is we call mutton fish.
Yeah.
You know, he's only getting sixpence a pound from. And then other people started buying them, and there were other people diving for them and that. But then when they become really expensive sort of items sort of, or seafood, then we missed out. And we should have been one of the, us and the Brileys should have been one of the first ones to have an abalone licence.
Mm.
Now everybody else has got them, and no Aboriginal person's got them.
Mm.
And to me, that's our resource. We never give it up. We never sold it. Same as the land, we never gave the land up, we never sold it, you know, and our culture is the oldest culture in the world, and we've been, you know, sort of been pushed away from it, really.
Mm. Yeah. What other changes have you seen since you've been fishing commercially in terms of, you know, the enforcement of regulations and things like that sort of made your job more difficult? You mentioned your quota for garfish was reduced and stuff.
Yeah, well, just say when I first got my license, or when I was about 20 or something like that, you know, and I could go and catch whatever type of fish I wanted to catch. I could go on any beach I wanted to go on, you know, and there was no restrictions on us. But now we're restricted on what beaches we can go on. It's either by the DPI department on what species of fish we can catch, the national parks, marine parks, and the council, and that with the access onto the beaches. So all up, I'd say we've probably lost about 80% of water.
So that's just the ability to drive onto different beaches down here to launch the boats.
Yeah, and we don't do no damage, because we drive onto a beach, that's the only access we use.
Yeah,
we drive on there and we drive off there, and you can go there a week after we've been on there. If you've had a strong wind from the southeast or something like that, or northeast, all our tracks cover up and you wouldn't even know it.
Mm.
You know, so we don't do no damage, and we should be able to, you know, access any beach to make a living. Because the majority of the fish we catch is migrating fish. If they're at a beach where we can't catch them, that's no good to catch them on. And they go onto a beach that's in the marine park, sentry zones, we've got to watch them go past there and not do nothing about it. But going back a fair few years back there now, when they opened Churros up when it was closed, they opened it up on a Saturday, and me young fella come down over Canlagan up on Hill there, and on a Sunday, and he rang me up and he said, "Dad," he said, "there's two good eats of mullet just going past here." He said, "You go down, we call it Cemetery, but they call it Melville Point." He said, "Go down there and you'll see them." So I go down there and I'm sitting up on the headland there, and he comes there because he's got better eyes than me. And he comes there, and as soon as he pulls up there, he said, "There they come now, Dad." And there's about 600 boxes there. So they come and they swam along that beach. It was light drizzly rain. They swam along the beach and right up into the corner near the island there. We could have caught those fish, but we weren't allowed to because it was a Sunday. We had a weekend closure where we're not allowed to fish on weekends.
Right.
And so we had to watch probably it could have been $10,000 or $12,000 worth of fish just swim past, which we could have caught, and there wasn't a single soul on the beach. And so they say, and I asked them why this weekend closure was in, and they said it's for the interest of the public and holiday makers. You know, I said, well, that's fair enough. I said, I can live with that. But I said, why does it come in on the 1st of October? I think it was the 1st of October, and ends at the end of February. It's in for, you know, like for 4 months. And we're not allowed to fish on weekends. And it's hard, being an Aboriginal, it's hard not to want to go down the beach and have a look.
Of course.
You know, like even if the sea's rough, I'll still drive down the beach and I'll sit up on that land and watch it. Even though we're not going to catch none, I still like to be there and look anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and then you go down there and you see the fish there and you're not allowed to catch them. And to me, that's wrong. I said to them, what do you do if it's a weekday and we're allowed to fish? I said, and there's a patch of fish coming along there and the beach is full of people. I said, what do we do then? He said, you can politely go and ask them to come out of the water or something. I said, yeah. I said, you can do that with some. I said, but some of them, I said, they might get a bit nasty or whatever, you know. So I said, if there's not many people on the beaches, we should be allowed to go on there and catch those fish.
Mm.
Because there's a lot of beaches that we can fish on where you might see three or four people on there. Mm. So that three or four people on a weekend closures, going to stop us from making a living.
So, and you did mention the reduction in your take for garfish. Has any of your other take been reduced since you've been fishing?
No, not at the time. Mainly just garfish, and like I said, we had the abalone and lobsters taken off. So we used to do, like we used to do the lobsters too. But we'd go, just say we, like tomorrow, we know it's going to be a nice day. We'll say, oh, we'll go down to Mullumbah Point, you know, we'll see if we can catch a patch of salmon. So we might go down there for half a day and not catch no fish, not even see any. So we come back home, we grab our diving gear, and we go and get 10 to 20 kilos of abalone or 40, 50 crays, you know, and then you're making your money.
Yeah, okay.
But these days you can't do that. If we don't catch fish, we don't get paid.
You don't have that option anymore.
No, we haven't got that option no more. And I think we should have, as original owners of this country and the resource, we should have a say in every decision that this department makes where we don't. You know, like they get around and they say they have consultation with the public, not like saying they have consultation with Aboriginal people, but they say they have consultation with the public, and the public agrees on this, the public agrees on that. And to me, I think it's a load of crap. They just say that. Or they'll have a consultation with a few people, and so they have a consultation with the public and they want this. And I reckon they're just telling fibs.
I was speaking to Wally Stewart this morning about the Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group, and that's something that's active now, and the native title claim is now registered. Do you see anything changing now at the moment or in the near future?
I think things have changed a bit because what we're saying to the department, you know, you show me proof of ownership that you own this resource and the land and whatever. You show me a proof of ownership and we'll abide by your rules and regulations. But you can't show me proof of ownership because you've got no proof that you own this resource. We can prove who we are and where we come from, you know. So we've got more rights than they've got. But we don't want to stop anyone else from using the resource. But we want to have a say in that resource and be able to access that resource like in abalone and lobsters. Mm. You know, like you do, you go and get a feed of abalone and you can get busted by fisheries. But they have backed off a lot. And I think one of the reasons why they're doing that too is because of the situation with the native title and our fishing rights group. And we're asking you show me proof of ownership. Because if you own something, you've got to be able to prove you own it. So if they can't prove that they own it, why are we, as original owners of this country, paying them money to access the resource that truly belongs to us? To me, it's wrong. We should have access to any beach. Like I said there before, the majority of the fish we catch are migrating fish. You know, garfish will come in and they lay in a bay, but you don't get them travelling like from down at Mullumbah Point right up to Browlea sort of thing. You know, they sort of come in from out in the deep and into sheltered bays when the wind blows hard. You know, they'll get into a sheltered bay. But they don't travel, you know, for miles and miles. But salmon, look, we don't catch a quantity of salmon we used to catch. People see us catch a patch of salmon, you know, just say that they might have 300 boxes in them, you know, and they see you catch salmon, they think, oh, you know, you're not going to catch nothing here. These guys just caught all the fish in the ocean. But they don't see what swims past them that don't bite. Because I sat over at Browlea there, and I watched one morning, and I watched two biggies, probably about 70 tonne in one patch, swim out past these half a dozen guys fishing on the headland in the corner of Browlea Beach there. Not one of them caught a fish. Then another patch come, nowhere near as big, swam out there, and then still no one caught a fish. They never got excited and seen them going past there, because I was watching with the binoculars. And then my son turned up, and we drove down along the beach, and there was another patch coming there, so we shot them in, and you've got to imagine what the guys out in the rocks would have been saying. Oh, well, you know, they've just caught all the fish. You're not going to catch them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got no idea because they've never been educated.
Yeah.
And we do get people come up and ask us questions when they see us sitting on a headland. You know, they might walk along the beach there, say, at 7 o'clock in the morning, come back there at 12 o'clock, and we're still sitting there. You know, probably thinking we're mad or something like that. I don't know. And then, you know, but you get the ones come up and they ask, you know, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you looking for? We explain to them. They want to know how you can tell. So you can tell by the dark colour in the water. You can tell what type of fish they are by the colour of them in the water and pretty much how many's in them.
Yeah. So why don't you catch that quantity? Why do you think you don't catch that quantity of salmon anymore?
Because you can't. It's no good putting 50 tonne of salmon into the markets.
Yeah, right.
you know. So you don't.
So unless
do that.
There's a cannery nearby, which there used to be.
We have had a couple of sales from, I think it was South Australia, I think, for bait, where we've caught them over a little period of time, like 30 or 40 ton, you know, and not in the one heap, you know. You might go and get 10 ton today, 5 ton and something like that, and then when they build them all up, then they'd pack them and send them to South Australia, I think it was, for bait. It's not that we're not catching a quantity like we used to catch. It's not because they're not there, because they're there thicker.
Yeah, okay.
And the same as mullet, like, you know, like when the mullet travel, like I'm sitting over Prowley there and there could be 10 or 15 ton of mullet there, or, you know, or more, and it comes dark and they're still there, so you go home. You go over there the next day and you don't see them, and you might not see them fish again.
Mm.
So when people say, you know, like, you know, you're catching, you're raping the ocean, you're catching all the fish in the ocean, it's a load of crap.
Mm.
Because when it comes to mullet, we wouldn't catch 50% of what we see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
And the longer they stay in the river, the harder it is for the weather to push them out. And normally then when you get a bit of weather and it pushes them out, they don't come along the beaches, they go straight out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Apparently they spawn out to sea, that's what I reckon.
Mm-hmm. How long's your family been commercially fishing for?
Well, I don't know how many years it's been, but my son Craig fishes with me. I've got four boys and he fishes with me. He's a sixth generation.
Yeah, sixth generation. Wow. Yeah. Do you think that you'll be able to continue this tradition in your family? You know, it's NAIDOC week this week. I was speaking to Wally about it just before, and it's talking about healing country. Do you see, you know, another six generations of fishing in your family?
Unless the rules and regulations change and the family are allowed to access the main resource, which it can make money out of, and get rid of a few restrictions on us, it could do, but the way it stands right at the moment, I'd say no.
Mm.
Because it's hard to get them to come, because they're frightened of being prosecuted by fisheries.
Mm.
You know, so that's a big part in it, but I'd say right at the moment, I couldn't see there being another six generations.
Mm. Is there anything else that you guys are doing, or that the fishing rights group is doing, or anything else you want to tell me about before we finish?
Well, I'd just like the department and that to, you know, sit down, and when they have consultation and talking about rules and regulations and changes like that, they should involve us Indigenous fishermen and Indigenous people in general, because a lot of the rules and regulations they come up with, it's no good for us, you know. So, and we don't have a say in none of that, you know. But I think I'm feeling real confident about some things here, and I think we will see changes.
Let's hope so.
I hope so, because I just want to live long enough to see the changes, you know. Like, because I'm 71 years old, you know, and I've got 15 grandchildren, two great granddaughters, and another great grandchild on the way, and I'm pretty happy with my life the way it's gone. I've never drank or smoked in my life. My dad smoked for 2 years, from 16 to 18, and he never ever drank. He gave up the smoke. Would never walk into a pub or a club to talk to a friend or nothing. They'd have to come outside and talk to him. You know, I'm proud of, you know, to be an Aboriginal person. I wouldn't change who I am for anything in the world. I wouldn't change my job for anything in the world. I love it. We're our own boss. We come and go as we please. If we want to go fishing tomorrow, we'll go. If we don't, we don't.
Yeah.
Or if we go and sit there for half a day and we don't see nothing, so we'll go home, or we'll go somewhere else and have a look somewhere else. You know, and I just love it. Like, I tell people, I was born a fisherman, I'll die a fisherman.
Mm.
Yeah. I wouldn't do anything else.
Thanks so much for joining us for this special episode. A big thanks to Wally Stewart and Andrew Nye for joining us and sharing their stories. If you want to find out more about what they're up to, you can head to the New South Wales Aboriginal Fishing Rights Group on Facebook. We'll see you with the next episode.